So for this evening's entertainment and interest, I've got a topic proposed by one of our faithful lay disciples, and that is right speech within the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And as many of you are aware, this one's quite a tricky one to work with, because essentially you've got to be very, very sharp and on the ball to watch over and regulate your speech on a regular basis. But it's good to have the background knowledge to the way how we work with this particular parameter, because it's a very flexible, a wide field, and you can work with this particular aspect of Dharma in many, many different ways. And naturally, many of you are familiar with Ajahn Brahm's style of, say, teaching and counseling and engaging with people. And he has a very light-hearted and humorous perspective on life and on Dharma and on the experience of being a human being. And naturally that comes from the sense of genuine sense of like joy and happiness, deeper down in the mind, coming from very, very good and consistent meditation. But with all of us, essentially, in order to have very, very good speech habits across the range, you've got to be quite skillful, and your wisdom faculty needs to be developed at least to a small degree in order to catch your mind fast enough. And even with myself, even over the last five years, I've developed a propensity for teasing people in a friendly manner. That's how I sort of connect with people and make a more sort of light-hearted perspective on life and one's personal experience. Because sometimes we can get a bit heavy and serious about matters, and especially Thai people. They do this on a regular basis, and especially the monks. They do tend to sort of tease each other in conversation in a very, very light-hearted, friendly, affectionate manner. There's no malice intended. There's no putting down, and it's something that you feel. When somebody is teaching is teasing you in good spirits, and I was with a friend of mine in Thailand, and this particular monk is slightly senior to me. He's the number one project manager at Mupjan, and he's been building things, all his life, for the last say 20 years, and he's at the level of a structural engineer. There's virtually nothing that he can't build. The only area we can catch him out is mechanics, but he can basically. He's got the ability to do everything else, put up full buildings, wiring, plumbing, pipes, brickwork, slabs, the full business, and we're on a job at the back of the monastery complex, and they were setting up a plumbing circuit on a kuti which was way back. It was right on the very edge of the monastery boundary, and because it's a very, very steep gradient, and they had to get the plumbing right, the water tanks right, the electrical pumps and this and that, because it was running a shower and bathroom. And as he was conversing with the Thai monks, and he was talking in Thai and sort of broken English, because there was a couple of Thai monks, university graduates who had at least basic English. And as they were talking, and then he just turns around And he said, "Oh, he said, you know, maybe we should ask, you know, ask Achanapi's advice, you know, because he knew for a fact that I basically hadn't done any building at all over the previous 15 years, but it was just his way of getting me involved and just having a bit of fun, and you know, just having a little bit of sort of like light-hearted entertainment. But you know, it's like something that all of us understood. You know, it's something you can feel out. You know, when people tease you, you know, when people tease you or they joke around, you know, you know if they're coming from a reasonably wholesome mindset or whether they're just trying to sort of rip you off on some level or other. And but even myself, I mean, I quite actually like this kind of thing. I quite enjoy it. It adds a little bit of fun to monastic life. Even with the lay disciples, I can rock and roll with this kind of thing on a regular basis. But you know, but when we take things, you know, if we look at the Dhamma perspective, the Sutta perspective, what are the main parameters that we have, you know, the main guidelines for watching over, you know, the jewels that, you know, come forth from our mouths, our gobs, you know, the incredible things that we say. So the four main areas is the point number one is to not to misrepresent the truth or tell deliberate lies, but you know, there's quite a wide scope there, because it depends where you're coming from. It's not like, you know, cut and dry, black and white. You know, like I know people in professions. They could be social workers, welfare workers, nurses in say like surgical units. And one example was a gentleman who went in for open heart surgery. There was two gentlemen. They were good friends. They were in the same room, in beds next to each other, all going in for open heart surgery, for essentially advanced heart disease. They were having quadruple bypass, and so you know, the two guys, like Rob and Harry. And Harry went in first for his procedure, and unfortunately, because of complications, you know, with the cardiac structure with his heart, he went into heart failure, and the specialists weren't able to resuscitate him. And when he came back from, you know, so essentially he passed away on the operating table. And when it was Rob's turn to go in, the first thing he asked the nurse from the theatre who was bringing, who was transporting the patients, you know, from the surgical ward to the operating theatre, was, you know, how did Harry go? Was, you know, was his operation successful? And the first thing she said was, she said Harry's great. He's in recovery. His blood pressure's stable, and everything's fine. And the reason she did this, because you know, she was well aware that if she frightened his friend, you know, if he got worried, concerned, he got scared, you know, that both his vital signs would be affected, and it could potentially even like, you know, with the release of hormones and the activity, you know, the glandular activity, it could actually weaken his stability of his heart, and the biochemical processes, you know, from the glandular process in his body, and you know, these nurses are well aware that, you know, just even small differences can make, you know, they can make a really big deal when you've got somebody, you know, fully anaesthetized, and they basically, you know, they've shut your heart down, your circulation, and you're essentially like a warm corpse, you know, being maintained by machines. As soon as they disconnect the machines, the plugs, you know, you're as good as dead. So, you know, that's what she told his friend, and his friend went in, and had the procedure, and he was quite fortunate. You know, the procedure went well. He came out, went into recovery, and everything went according to plan. And then he found out later that his friend had passed away. But you know, this is a case where you can lie intentionally to a person's face, but you're doing it from a wholesome perspective. You're trying to protect this person, and you know, this can run a wide range from an extreme case like this to, you know, little things like when mums take their children to the dentist, and you know, they don't if the child says, you know, am I going to have a needle, or you know, am I going to have, you know, the like laughing gas? So, you know, whatever the dentist has got prepared for this child, that the mother's not going to you know, explain things in a way which, you know, essentially going to frighten the child, to increase the worry and the apprehension, because just the fear and the worry can be as bad as the needle going in, or you know, the potential extraction. And you know, quite a number of you have had extraction under, say, like laughing gas, and it's completely painless. You know, the person is just right. You know, essentially, the person's just right off their face. And I remember when I had my own tooth extracted. You know, the dentist actually had his knee on my chest, and he was using two hands to extract this back molar. He was using quite a lot of force, and I didn't even feel a thing. But that kind of perspective, there's, you know, you can argue the point, you know, that it was a complete lie, it was a white lie, but you know, you're looking at the quality of your intention, you know, where you're coming from in relation to the person that you're dealing with. And you know, it could be things like even within the financial sector, things like investments, shares, portfolios, and whatnot. That I know one particular investment broker in Queensland, and but he would actually, when he would advise his clients, he always advised them, you know, because he knew the business, he knew how tricky and unpredictable and unstable it was, and just how sharp and how much attention, you know, how much focus and how much you've got to be on the ball to actually make money in this area. You know, you've got to be, I mean, really highly polished and committed a lot of time and energy and study and resources. But he would always advise his people on the side of caution. You know, he would never, regardless of circumstances, he would always advise them in a way with their investments or a potential portfolio of the dangers. He would even if you misrepresented the truth. So, for example, you could have had an investment portfolio which had coming from a very, very secure organisation with a very, very good track record, consistent over 5 years. He would still instill a sense of caution and being careful, mindful, because you know, these things aren't consistent. You know, anyone who gets involved in this business will tell you, you know, you've got to be incredibly careful, and you can't say, like, take your eyes off the ball, so to speak. But mainly doing that through a sense of say care and responsibility and understanding. And so, you know, there are different scenarios and there are levels, but within the Buddha's framework, the quality of intention is paramount. This is a crucial principle in regard to whatever you're actually saying, you know, even to oneself or to other people, because you know, you can have circumstances where you can actually lie to yourself. You know, this one's quite easy to do. And you know, people can talk themselves, even Dhamma, you know, long-term Dhamma practitioners can talk themselves into almost anything. if they feel strongly about a particular issue. And you know, like I knew one particular girl who was, you know, the circumstances weren't suitable for her to have a child at that time, but because of her age, that you know, her biological clock was ticking and she could feel the pressure. You know, her body was telling her that, you know, you need to have a baby within the next, you know, 4-5 years, you know, otherwise your possibly the health and welfare of the baby could potentially be compromised. It's not like an absolute, but, you know, any female will tell you that, you know, they can feel it. They know when is the right time to have a child and when the limit is. It's like your body is telling you when your body is fruitful for childbearing. And she was talking with me this concern about me, and she was talking about other couples had told her that it was, you know, to have a baby was, you know, it really just improved their Dharma practice and their understanding of the mind, and you know, being a parent and guiding this little being, and it was so profound that it was almost like spiritual. And you know, I would never tut-tut this kind of experience, because, you know, naturally I've never had kids myself, and especially some mothers, you know, will tell you that, you know, their child is like a gift from the Deva worlds. And one young woman I knew who from India, her child was quite special. He was Australian Indian, of Australian Indian descent, but the boy had like sandy blonde hair and like piercing like green eyes. It was quite unusual, and you know, he was very, very confident child. But without sidetracking too much, this particular lady was, you know, essentially just talking herself into it, you know, coming from an underlying intentions. You know, you can easily talk to parents who may feel that, you know, or, you know, I mean, you know, children are, you know, they are hard work. They love their, you know, they love their kids. They would. Some parents will give their life without even, you know, no hesitation. They would actually give their life for their child, not even blink. And but, you know, this particular person, you could see underneath the surface, the surface level of the mind was being affected, and she was, you know, like talking herself into it, you know, trying to convince herself that, you know, it was the right way to go. So, you know, even with ourselves, you know, with the underlying defilements in the mind, we can lie and deceive ourselves. You know, you can get a person who talks about, you know, who's been talking about this for like, you know, 30 years about making these incredible life changes, and I'm going to do this and do that. And, you know, they're not silly people. They're quite intelligent, but they've been doing it for 30 years. And you can see that, you know, they're in their comfort zone. They don't really want to. It's like it doesn't seem to be enough energy. They don't want to put forth effort and really make the changes which are necessary. And a second principle within this category is divisive speech. And even with the monks, you've got it. This one can actually be quite refined, but you feel it out. You look at the quality of the intention. If you want to know exactly, you know, where you are at, you know, when you're talking with people, you might be trying to manipulate some kind of scenario. You're trying to get somebody on side. You're trying to put yourself and this person against another individual, or maybe get a group of people against a certain individual. that the, you know, regardless of the methods and the avenues, that the intention will always be very, very clear exactly where you're coming from, because you're going back to the root source deeper down in the mind. You may not see the original course because it can be quite deep within the personality, and even if you've been practicing for even 10 or 20 years, you know, you still can do these things at times without full awareness. When you've been going for like 10 years, if you're quite honest with yourself, you can almost catch it almost every single time, because you know you understand the way the defilements work in the mind, and you've got the speed. As soon as the state comes up, you can see it for what it is. You know, because of the, you get increased calm, clarity in the mind, and you don't get fooled so easily. So, you know, we have the ability to spot it, you know, to spot the mind state, to spot it quickly. And if you put the brakes on, and then you try to steer the mind in a more wholesome direction. You know, there may be another of avenues available to you. And so, you know, when we look at divisive speech, so you know, what are we, you know, what are we actually, you know, talking about here? So it can run the range, you know, from, say, like things like, you know, like soft, you know, like things which are more like the soft option, where you could be, you can do this even when you tease people, and but most, you know, people who are reasonably sensitive can usually pick it up if they know your character well enough. You know, it's like that, you know, if you tease a person with malice, you know, maybe you're aiming to sort of rip them off, maybe put them down in a little way. Maybe you're trying to expose a weakness or something of this sort. You know, trying to compromise the person's character in an unwholesome manner. You know, that would be very, like, very, very clear to yourself if you're sharp enough. And so people can do these very kind of without sounding a little bit rough. You know, people can do these very, very subtle bitchy things with each other. And even the monks, you know, if they've got something in for someone, or they just can't get along with a particular individual, you know, this kind of mind state, you know, will come up. But the way I see things, if you've got a scenario with someone, if you don't get along with someone at all, you know, one of the best ways to deal with this particular individual is just don't communicate with them at all unless it's absolutely necessary. As soon as you engage them, if you know for a fact that trouble's going to come up, or there's going to be some contention or arguments, or you know, there's going to be some very, very, you know, it's going to start getting evil. You know, you just don't engage them. You don't even speak to them. So no opportunity will arise for this, you know, any kind of nasty, ugly, say, bitchy, revengeful kind of attacks on the person's character or say, like, responses to scenarios. So, so essentially, you know, what are we aiming at? If I'm aiming at, or if anyone's aiming at, you know, say like divisive speech, you know, what actually am I aiming at? And I want to put that person down. I want to demean them. I want to hurt them. I want to make them small. I want to make them, you know, like insignificant. You know, they're not important. You know, you want to reduce the value and the worth of that person, or you know, you may want to hurt them on some level. You know, there might be a little payback in progress. So let's see now. And another principle there, third principle is You say like tale bearing. You know, when you're relating with other people or within a group of individuals, you know, do we gossip and we tell tales and little tidbits and little gossipy things about different people? And you know, because I don't have internet access very often. I don't even get involved in email, and it's absolutely necessary. There's just the amount of time it takes up. And you know, traipsing over to Jhana Groves, you know, is not my idea of a good time. So, but especially with social media, with Twitter, what would you call it, the Facebook, and all these other avenues for social communication, there's actually more avenues for people to basically attack each other, to spite each other, to gossip and all this kind of thing. I mean, not saying that the Buddhist people would do this. That, you know, they would tend to avoid it because their friends might look down on them or say, you know, like, what are you doing? You know, like bagging this person. You're supposed to be on, you know, on five precepts, and you know, you're getting into this kind of stuff. So, you know, this whole business, you know, with the tale bearing, you know, making other people look bad and criticizing and whatnot, you know, we have like bad thoughts in relation with this individual. And so, you know, so we look at the fourth point will come to me eventually. But when we look at these four main categories, what are we trying to do here? You know, so we have the four main areas of guarding one's speech, and so essentially we're trying to refrain from unskillful states of mind and projecting those out onto other people and into the world. Because when you look at the way the mind works, you know, projection is a very, very common psychological principle. You know, we have this mind state, you know, deeper down, either at the surface level or deeper down in consciousness, and then we bounce it out on someone else or some situation. And this is where this principle of blame, praise and blame, one pair of the four worldly dhammas comes into play, because blame is a very, very flexible word. It can cover many, many different things. But you're holding something outside of you responsible for the internal state, for the way that you feel. So I'm projecting out and I'm blaming my stuff on someone else or on circumstances. It's the easiest thing in the world. If I have some personal issues, I can be incredibly, you know, I mean, very, very sharp and very bright, and but you know, I can do this kind of thing on a regular basis, and I'm very, very skillful at it. So you know, if people, you know, if you annoy me, if you upset me, if you say something I don't like, you know, basically I will pin something on you. I'll either attack your weaknesses, I'll ridicule you. I'll make you look foolish, you know, this, that, and the other. There's all sorts of little tricks, you know, coming from the underlying defilements in the mind. You know, I wouldn't say a thousand, that's an exaggeration, but there's dozens of different ways that, you know, you can project your stuff out into the world. Because when you do that, you're not taking responsibility for yourself. You're not actually seeing with insight, honestly, you know, what's actually going on in your mind. And for some people, you may see the active process within oneself, but you may continue to do this through force of habit, or it's just a very, very easy way to, instead of taking responsibility for oneself, getting one's own stuff together. You know, I'll just pin it on you or some some event or something which happened, you know, like 20 years ago, or stuff like, you know, or my, you know, the reason why I grew up to be a petty thief was because my father never gave me enough pocket money when I was a child. You know, my dad didn't give me much pocket money either, but I didn't go around shoplifting and ripping people off. So, you know, there are, you know, with Dhamma, there's no absolute black and white, because the mind, you know, the mind can throw up absolutely tens of thousands of different mind states with different shades. So it's very difficult to, you know, to really pin down, absolutely etched in stone, you know, something has to be a certain way in relation with Dharma principles. That you can have a wide spectrum of experience within, say, like a certain principle. You know, you can explore, like you can take one point, and if you're very, very knowledgeable, articulate, you know, you can express yourself very, very clearly in many, many different ways. And so people, you can get a really good feel for, you know, for what you're talking about, like a shared understanding. And so what we're aiming at is, you know, developing one's wisdom faculty. So, you know, as we talk, as we converse, as we communicate with others, that, you know, we look at the sense of the feeling tone. When you look at the quality of one's intention, you know, it's the feeling tone which will make your position very, very clearly known to you, because mental states can be quite refined. Underlying defilements can be very, very refined. And, you know, essentially, like the monks, they're like experts in defilements, because, you know, they go through probably more defilements than the lay disciples do on a day-to-day basis. Which comes from, because we're expected to do at least several hours of meditation a day, you know, if you have that particular disposition. And, you know, because it depends very much on the personal character. But the feeling tone will make your intention very, very distinct from other mind states and intentions which are actually rising in consciousness. And when you look at the feeling tone, you'll see very, very clearly what you are actually up to. When you see the thought process arise, the feeling tone will tell you, if you're sharp enough and you're sensitive enough, will show you very, very accurately where you're actually coming from and what you're aiming at. And then if you catch it early, and then you say to yourself, that particular mind state, you know, is it largely wholesome or unwholesome? It is possible to have a mix of say two or three intentions in a particular state of mind. You know, I could be approaching a certain individual, and, you know, I could be interested in helping and supporting their practice, which is my primary motive. But also, I could be maybe looking for some kind of small support on some level, small level of material support, or I could be looking for, you know, companionship, or, you know, or like interesting conversation, you know, or networking. You know, there's all sorts of prerogatives that people have. So, a particular mind state could have an underlying, you know, maybe could have three or four underlying intentions. But if we look, you know, if you look at the totality of it, look at the big picture, if we look at the mind state, look at it in its completeness, you know, is it largely wholesome or unwholesome in nature? And that'll make it, you know, reasonably clear to you as you get more skillful with this type of thing. So, you know, your wisdom faculty is going to be one of of, you know, trying to increase the, you know, in relation with the regulation of one's speech, you know, increasing the speed, the sharpness of the mind, having the underlying awareness of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome in nature. You know, what is what is conducive or what is of no benefit to anyone whatsoever. And people can do things, they can say things, and sometimes they're just a complete waste of time. I remember getting in a conversation with someone down at the shower block, and this particular person wasn't a meditator. And when I walked away, I mean, I realised that quite quickly. But what they were talking about was quite interesting and informative. And after 30 minutes, after I walked away, I just realised what a complete waste of time that was. And even myself, like I'm not a busy person whatsoever compared to Achyam Brahm, Sujato, Brahmali. You know, I tend to cruise. You know, I'm not interested in basically living my monk's life in fourth gear. It's not the way I operate. But with all of us, and even myself, sometimes we can actually waste one's say both personal time, work time, and Dharma time, getting involved in things which are quite, say, unskillful and almost completely worthless. So when you look at many underlying principles of Dharma, and especially speech, one's wisdom faculty needs to really be, brought to the forefront, to watch over, to screen one's speech, and then to feel what's appropriate for time and place, because you may behave, you're going to, what's expected may be quite different according to time and circumstances and the people that you associate with, and many of us we adjust our personal behavior in relation with the people that we relate to. So, but even with the monastics, where you're expected to take one's speech to a more refined level, because you're supposed to be like actively working on one's defilements and actually rubbing away and eroding the defilements in the mind, which are essentially the seeds for rebirth in samsara, because with all of us, every time we follow, an unwholesome intention, it's like we're watering the seed, which lies a little bit deeper down in the mind, and that habit, that habitual tendency, which comes from our past karma, it's like a karmic pattern that we've engaged in, in many previous occasions, and not only in the current life and past lives, that's going to be nourished and that's going to grow and be strengthened in this intensity. And what we are aiming at is especially with the monastics, is undermining. The underlying tendencies which will bring this current consciousness to rebirth. We want to, and for the lay disciples, you're looking at weakening those unwholesome intentions, which are the seeds for rebirth. Both in the moving in, to the future when you leave the current life. So what kind of speech do we think is appropriate and skillful? What do we think according not to what I think, but according to what the Buddha instructed in the suttas, that with all of us have to take as our guidelines, which are very, very deep, profound, and accurate, and that we don't put forth our own, say, our own ideas and our own views and principles. So, you know, we refer to the suttas, and essentially if you follow the sutta formulation, you really can't go too far wrong. So, you know, what kind of speech did the Buddha recommend for the practitioners? And so the one of the factors is say speech which is based in, say, like kindness and freedom from hostility, you know, freedom from anger. So words which are reasonably, I mean, it may not be this may not particularly gel with every single, you know, with every Tom, Dick and Harry who's walking in the street, but, you know, words which are gentle and kind and pleasant and soothing to the ear. You know, I mean, if you told the average person, non-Buddhist, non-religious person walking the street, you know, if you told this is one of the guidelines that the Buddha laid down, I mean, some of these people might just laugh in your face because it's so nice. And you know, the world and current, you know, just current life, you know, working life, the economic conditions, you know, things can be quite intense and quite stressful for people. And, you know, they haven't got time to be nice and kind to other people. They just, you know, they just want to go to work and they want to make money and they want to, you know, raise their kids and send them to university and follow their hobbies and go on, you know, go on their overseas holiday each year. And, you know, they've got their own tangent on this. So you don't have to be like, you know, like Mother Teresa or Gandhi, but, you know, you speak in a way which essentially doesn't, like, harm another person, especially on the emotional level, because that's where they're going to feel it. So we don't actually speak in a way which incites, say, like an aversive reaction from that individual. And every single one of us can feel it. All meditators are well aware of this one, that when you talk with a person, that you don't deliberately say things which incite them and push their buttons. You know, it's just a common sense principle that, you know, you know, if you want to have good relations with other people, you know, you just don't say things or treat them in a manner which, like, really ticks them off or potentially riles them. And so the other speech which is appropriate and wholesome in nature is, just give me 20, 30 seconds. I'm starting to fade away a bit. Speech which is not blameworthy. So I speak in a manner where my wise companions in the holy life will not find fault or reproach me. So, you know, when I'm chit-chatting with the monks, you know, if I talk in a way which is absolutely ridiculous, or I had one of the senior monks essentially call me frivolous and a maker of nonsense, because I was teasing another one of the monks, you know, probably for the 100th time or so, but, you know, just in a friendly, jokey manner, you know, just more like in a sense of like friendliness, you know, just having a little bit of fun together. And I was accused of being you know, just like talking nonsense and being frivolous. And I just when they said that, I just laughed. I thought it was just so funny. It was probably the best thing I heard all day. And it's the kind of personal take you have on it. That particular individual was being dead, you know, quite serious with a touch of humour, but they were being straight down the line, being quite proper. And you know, when you're like, you know, I'll be coming up to say like to 20 rains this year, and I'll just tell you straight up, you won't see me acting in a straight, a very very straight and tight and strict intense manner. I absolutely refuse to do it. And regardless of what people say, I'll keep my speech within parameters. But if I want to joke around, if I want to have fun with my friends or have fun with the lay disciples, you know, I will continue to do that. But I'm quite careful with this. I do this with people I know, and I feel people out. If people don't like it, I just drop it straight away. And so with say like skillfulness, we're aiming at a quality of speech, which is these words are quite interesting. I don't use these very very often. I should have checked the dictionary before I came in tonight. But like words which are well reasoned, and to be honest, I really don't know what that. I'll give you my take on it. What that word means, to be well reasoned. So words which are well reasoned, words which, or say some sentence structure which is like thought through, which has been reviewed, you know, made previously. You know, you may feel that it's appropriate for time and place. It's skillful. It's got some degree of insight or wisdom. You know, it's of benefit to oneself or others. You know, I'm trying to communicate or impart something, you know, which may or may not be useful to you, depending on your opinion or your take. So you know that skillfulness. You know, do I have a sense, you know, what this person needs, or you know, is this actually suitable for where they are at in their practice, and you know, will they actually understand what, you know, what I'm trying to convey, or what we're trying to like comprehend here, and you know, because this word skillfulness, it's got and the word wisdom, you know, these have very wide parameters. You know, that the mind is a very very big space. It's a big, big world in there. You know, once you really start to get peaceful, you know, it's like you open up a little universe inside you, and there's more and more space for the insight and the understanding to develop. So it's quite an interesting experience that as the space increases, you know, if you're investigating, the insight knowledge increases, even though you're not thinking very much at all. Your mind is just quiet, you know, constantly, 7 days a week. But one's understanding increases, you know, within this, you know, it's what would you call it? Like, so I wouldn't call it, say, like beginner's mind, but the Zen, you know, like big mind as the practice, increases in quality over the years. So you know, so essentially you're looking at, you know, the suitability, time and place, you know, what's appropriate, does the person understand you, and you know, do they understand, you know, where you're coming from. And in relation with the monastics, that, you know, even the Buddha laid down really tight guidelines that the monks and nuns should not talk about armies and about kings and about ministers and about talk of the street and the well, you know, talking about, you know, like soldiers and battles and you know, scents and flowers and all sorts of things. You know, there's got to be at least a dozen in that category. And you know, I mean, why did the Buddha put emphasis on that even with the monastics? You know, because they're quite strict categories that the Buddha recommended, and essentially that you just can't get involved in any kind of real, say, like worldly, like dhammas, you know, like worldly knowledge, gossip, you know, the kind of stuff that you know that even you people may feel is just a complete waste of time. You know, you've all got a sense of it. You know, you know for yourself when you spend 5 minutes with someone, and you know, you think to yourself, you know, I mean, you've got nothing against them, but you know for a fact it was just a complete waste of time. You know, if both of you didn't get any benefit from it whatsoever, I mean, why did I even waste my, not being harsh, but you know, why did we even waste our mental energy? So, but the guy, it's quite, I wouldn't say funny, but you know, when you're looking at the clear cut definition, what the Buddha recommended for the monastics to talk about was what the you know, like the Four Noble Truths, that your talk should circle around the Four Noble Truths. You know, there is suffering, you know, the cause of suffering, the path and the cessation. And but I'm not sure exactly how even our monks, or even the most incredibly strict monks in the best monasteries in Thailand, Burma, or Sri Lanka, I just don't know how long they could stand it, you know, realistically, because it's an incredibly strict parameter. It's not like the Buddha's, this is a recommendation. He's not like forcing you. He's not like, you know, putting the screws on and demanding that you do this. But you know, if you're really looking at, say, like, you know, like top class dialogue and engagement between monastics, or even maybe the practitioners on long meditation retreats, you know, could be anything from 10 days to 30 days to 3 to 6 months. That's the kind of you know, the parameter you know, that you're looking at. So when we look at the totality of one's speech, that you know, naturally that the qualities that one develops are going to, you know, take quite, you know, because essentially, you know, you're working against long set ingrained habits in the mind, which go quite deep into your personal karma, into past lives. And so in order to correct one, these unwholesome tendencies, you know, one has to put forth, say, like, wise effort in this particular area. And just gradually, one wears down these underlying tendencies of mind, and one wears them down and replaces them with, say, like, good habits, good speech habits, which one try to strengthen and maintain over the months and the years. And because if you look at the a very easy way to understand this, to put this into a nutshell, you know, which is comprehensible to the vast majority of adults, is, you know, you just imagine you know, to yourself, you know, is what I'm actually saying, you know, could it be considered, like, you know, you don't have to be an expert in Dharma or Vinaya, but you know, you just ask yourself, you know, what I actually spoke of with that person, or that business meeting, or that social engagement, you know, did I actually generate any degree of bad karma at that time? And you know, that would give you like a sense. You know, people need to know like a minimum level of say background information. But if you feel within yourself, you know, the intentions, where you were coming from, you know, did I actually create some bad karma in that particular scenario? And that will give you a sense for whether one is actually moving in a wholesome, or unwholesome direction. So I'll bring the talk to a close, and I will open the floor for any challenging statements, views, or opinions. I am open to all and sundry. Thank you, thank you. Yep, yep, we've got some questions on the roll. I'll just put my reading glasses on. So we have Mark from Cleveland, USA. Dear Achan, I have a family member who suffers from mental illness. I'm very well versed in this one. Where she's easily provoked. She has a volatile mood and her behavior affects the family, particularly the children. Can you comment on right speech in this scenario? Well, you know, like previously I was a registered nurse, and I worked in mental health for roughly about 12 months. And for example, this particular lady who's easily provoked, has a volatile mood, and her behavior affects her family, the way to work with somebody like this is to soften the mind state to the best of her ability. And we had an example of many years ago. A lady came from Melbourne. She left the psychiatric ward, one of the major hospitals in Melbourne, and she flew over to Perth. She's really very, very, very smart lady, very resourceful. And she flew in, and she spent all day traveling around to different offices and visiting political representatives in the local community, going to police stations and security agencies and all sorts of things. You know, she thought that the monks were talking through the walls, and ASIO was spying on her, and just a classic paranoid delusions you see with this particular area of schizophrenia. And the easiest one, you can't rationalize, because I've been in contact, not only just in the mental health system, but I'm always in contact with people with mental health issues. And the easiest way to deal with this one is with these fearful, paranoid, angry, suspicious feelings. You've got to work with the meditation in a way which softens these potentially, say, provocative disruptive, like really disruptive emotions. You know, don't get into any kind of analysis or any kind of, you know, anything like that. Go straight to the emotion. Now, even if a person is psychologically or mentally unstable, you zero in on the feeling, just like a normal person. You go straight to compassion and metta, and you get that individual, if you can, to do absolute minimum 5 to 10 minutes of loving kindness for themselves, because this is where the problem's coming from. You know, every single day, or maybe several times a day, and if they have the strength of mind and they're prepared to play ball with you, you get them to do it for like 20 to 30 minutes every single day, 7 days a week, and I absolutely guarantee you, you should easily, you get them to do 30 minutes a day, you should see a change in their behavior within 7 days. And, you know, people think, oh, you know, the metta and compassion, it's such a nice, fluffy meditation. But don't ever underestimate this, because this really, really goes deep. And I've seen people with paranoid schizophrenia, and this particular lady, she even wrote us a letter, and she said that she got a reduction in the delusions that she was experiencing. And I've seen this with many other people. Those disruptive and damaging emotions that they experience because of the, you know, it could be like drug and alcohol damage, it could be genetics, There's all sorts of things, you know, chemicals and whatnot, which are the source, the exacerbation. And but the easiest way, zero in on the emotion and then use, especially the Brahma Viharas, the first two, loving kindness and compassion in large quantities. And if you feel that the individual, if the softening effect is just not obvious, you know, say for example, a person's a hard case, and the and their mother or father or their sibling feels that it's not strong enough, get them to radiate to the family and all beings. Radiate to the people who are living with them, who are constantly in contact with them and have to deal with them, and then take it to the full range, to all beings, and do it, you know, if you want to develop some real strength, you do it relaxed, but you do it continuously. Constant recitation, you know, for minimum 5 minutes up to 30 minutes a day. And, you know, you will see, you know, this is one of the most effective ways outside of medication that I've seen. But I'm not saying this is a be-all and end-all, because, you know, many of you know that once your friend or your family member or your co-worker goes off their medication, you know, they go completely off the wall and they're virtually uncontrollable. I had a young guy come in about 4 or 5 weeks back, and he was like angry, paranoid, fearful. But like I know this young guy like really, really well, and I could see it straight away. And he was complaining about the nursing staff. They had him in a lockup ward, and then eventually, you know, they were jabbing him intramuscular clozapine and, you know, all sorts of injectable drugs to get him stabilized, because he refused to, you know, to take his medication. So, you know, they give you the hard cookie approach. So he was going on and on and on. He was complaining, angry, shouting a bit. But the thing was, he brought it on himself. But 7 days later, as soon as they got him stabilized, he come back. He was like, you know, it was like a new man. He was just so calm and peaceful. He was still mentally active, but there was an incredible difference. So, if you've got somebody who's, and all of you know that they've, you know, most of these people have got to take their medication. If it's a genuine diagnosis and you know them, you know, you live with them, they're your child, they're your brother, sister, and you know that, you know, when they go off, you know, when they're off the wall, you know exactly why, and they've got to take the tablets. But if it's not, if it's still not enough, even if they're under a good consultant or psychiatrist and the drugs are still not holding the symptoms, you know, get them to really, really, you know, put effort in with the loving kindness and compassionate. And it might take, you know, I mean, it could take 3 months. They may have to do this every single day for 3 months to really get a rock solid effect. But to give you an example, I had one couple who came to see me, came upstairs, and, you know, quite a nice young couple. And the girl, you could tell that the girl's character was good. She was from a simple background in northeast Thailand, but she had a level of insight. She just wasn't completely deluded. You know, she was smart enough to realize that, you know, she had to correct this disorder. So there were the delusions that you see with paranoid schizophrenia, but also the bipolar as well. So, you know, she was right off her face, and she hadn't slept for like 3 days. She was pacing the house, you know, ranting and raving, thought that spirits were out to get her, out to kill her. And her poor husband, you know, was, you know, finding this was, you know, quite difficult to deal with. But you could see that she had enough insight to come to the monastery and try to get some meditation advice, some Dhamma advice, and correct this thing, because it was driving her crazy. But she couldn't sleep. So you just imagine being tormented by spirits constantly, day and night, but you just can't get a rest whatsoever from this phenomenon. And so it all starts with the loving kindness and the without without getting too expansive with this, loving kindness is may I be happy, successful and confident in life. May I love and respect myself. May I be joyful and wise. May I develop in wholesome qualities. And then compassion is based in may I be free from feelings of fear, paranoia, suspicion. May I be free from negativity and states of affliction. May I be free from worry, concern, and feel comfortable with my family members. You know, each individual knows exactly what words are necessary to balance the state of difficulty. And so that's exactly what you do. And loving kindness, compassion, and then you just feel it out. But also that the person needs to develop some insight as well. They may fall for the thought processes quite readily. You know, they may believe the voices, they may believe the hallucinations, and because the stuff is right in their face. You know, as far as they're concerned, it's reality. You can't rationalize or convince them otherwise that it's not real, because you know, for them, it's as real as the sky. You know, it's as real as the sky is blue. So, but you know, they need to also try to develop an understanding of their thought processes. Try to catch it early. Don't wait till you get snowballed, till you get taken over. As soon as it comes up, catch it. Try to understand it. Understand that this is apparent. You know, they can even do things like label. You know, that this is a paranoid feeling, or I'm feeling fearful. You know, keep track of it. Keep your mindfulness on it, and know exactly where you stand. Because if I suffer from mental illness, and I don't even understand where my thought processes are coming from, or where they're even going to, you know, it's going to make it very, very difficult for me to actually get a grasp on where I'm at any time. You know, there's got to be a degree of insight and understanding, even in a gentle way. Even if they label the thoughts, this thought is fearful, suspicious, paranoid, or when they care about their family, you know, they label that particular thought. So they're labeling both the good and the bad, and then they start to see the way their mind works. They see the patterns, they see the way that thoughts are connected, the way they stimulate each other. You know, they get a better feel for the big picture. So, Rob from New Zealand. Dear Achan, modern research says some sutras were not said by the Buddha, i.e. their authorship is a lie, and thus wrong speech. If I test such a teaching and reject it, is that not a slippery slope? Well, even the Buddha said that, you know, he didn't expect any of you people to believe everything he taught and said. You know, he told you to come and see. I think the Pali is ehi passiko. That's the Pali. Come and see for yourself. So just don't just be a blind. Uninformed individual. One needs to actually test. You know, like for example, I've got no qualms whatsoever if people want to. You know, I'm not a scholar to any degree whatsoever, but I won't even sweat. People can challenge me on anything in relation with suttas, meditation, but not say Buddhist archaeology. That's not my strong point. But, you know, the Dhamma is there to be tried and tested. The Buddha doesn't expect you, and the monks don't expect you to believe everything the Buddha said in the suttas, you know, the full canon, the Udana, the Itiwuka, you know, and all the other parables and sayings of the brethren and the enlightened nuns. He doesn't expect you to believe all that. You test the teaching for yourself. Put it into practice, test it, feel it out, and see if it actually works. Because if you put it to the test, it makes sense to you, it's workable, you'll be much more likely to believe it in the long run, and you won't just take it on faith. You'll take it as a proven principle that you see based in insight knowledge, which is actually workable, which can be applied and is workable within you know this world that we live in. So yeah, the same principle cuts the ice. You know, it's quite okay for you to reject any of the teachings that the Buddha taught, but you know, you've got to be fair in the sense where you put it to the test and then make your own assessment over time. Your insight maybe in the beginning, maybe the first 12 months, you may not be prepared to believe, you know, certain things. The monks might say things which are completely, you may feel are completely outrageous, but maybe after 5 years or 10 years, because of your own personal insight practice, you are prepared to believe it and take it on board. Because you know, people are at different levels of development. So you have to prove and test things for yourself. So, were there any other questions before we wrap it up?
Yes.
Yeah, which person?
Here I am.
Let me just swap hands. It's like the blind leading the blind.
Thank you for tonight.
No trouble.
What works for me is loving kindness, compassion for myself and for the other person when I'm having difficulties. When there's problems, I actually sit down and chant and send them loving kindness and send it and myself and chant for solutions and wisdom. And that's worked for me. It creates miracles. Thank you.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very, very simple practices, but, you know, don't ever underestimate them. It really goes deep. It goes right through your personality. It can basically affect, you know, and shape almost every area, any area of your personality you can think of. Are there any other?
Ajahn Abhi, actually, you know, right speech, you know, plays a very important part in our Theravada Buddhist practice, you know, which a lot of us, we don't realize, you know, the Buddha was telling us to watch our body, speech and mind. You know, these three things come together, I think, and in the Eightfold Path, the third one is the right speech. You know, for our well-being, you know, like, say we speak well this thing, okay, we bring happiness to ourselves and the people around us. So that plays a very important part, which a lot of us, we don't realize that. What do you think?
I mean, you know, especially when we're moving in the world, you know, because things are so, you know, the world is so fast, you know, people are so busy and you've got so much happening, you've got so much on your plate. It's very easy to slip. And this is where, you know, speech is the easiest thing to slip with, because it's so fast and it's so subtle. It's only when someone maybe explodes with anger or you know, just lies to someone's face that they actually realize they've done something wrong. But sometimes it's just so subtle. The average person who's possibly even distracted may not even see it initially. But it's one of the areas which takes the one of the highest levels of skill to really like polish, but depending on people's capabilities, because some people may want to be like good Buddhists and whatnot and good practitioners, but you know they can still be quite playful. And they're not prepared to give that up, because they find that playfulness adds a sense of friendliness and social cohesion and relaxes people. And they tend to enjoy other people's company more often. And so each individual, you know, according to their temperament, you know, makes the adjustments and whatnot. But you just keep yourself in a comfortable range, and you just practice just gently as the weeks and the months go by. But if you just watch your speech all the time, it will just, if you want to establish mindfulness, it will make you really sharp. You just do it for one day. Every single word you say, just watch. You just use that as a tool. Watch every single word you say, and that will sharpen your mindfulness. Like you won't believe, because your speech is just so fast. The mind state and the underlying intentions are like lightning, and then you actually have to keep track of that constantly. And this is the reason it makes you so sharp. Were there any other questions at all? Okay, we'll call it an evening. Thank you very much for your attention. It's been a wonderful crowd.